2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 235. What a long, strange trip it's been. The 7th East Press, 20 years later. Panelists Maxine Hanks, Ron Pritis, Gary Bergera, and Anthony Schmidt.
So, do you think we should start? Our panel is now here. I'd like to welcome you to our session, What a Long, Strange Trip It's Been, the 7th East Press, 20 years later. And I think I'm just going to launch into the slideshow and then introduce the panelists afterward. How does that sound? They're kind of wandering in. And for anybody who gets the tape and listens to the tape, you're going to be disappointed because this is a visual presentation, so it loses a lot in the audio version. If someone would like to hit the lights, I'm going to see if I can read in the dark. I think this will work. It's been 20 years since Ron Pritis, Anthony Schmidt, Albert Peck, and Maxine Hanks, you can tell it's been 20 years, stayed up all night to produce the first issue of the 7th East Press independent newspaper. But the images are still as vivid as the lessons that continue to echo. Over 100 photo slides will capture moments recalling this unusual experiment in student publishing and Mormon studies. Snapshots reveal a skeleton crew, whoops, wrong one, oh well, of full-time volunteers, obsessed with the cause and surprised by what it enabled them to do. I think I'll go back to her wishing she was a skeleton. Photo histories like this one are rare, but I was able to compile these slides from many photographs taken by myself and Scott Dunn, Sissy Warner, Brad Slade, and a few other people. Still, this is a very incomplete photo history. It's lopsided with too many photos of a few of us and too few photos of some of us and no photos of most of the people who wrote for the paper. But a slideshow is a good way to tell a complex story. The press was as complex as Mormon history itself. It was a whirlwind of discovery and destiny where individuals created their own vortex as they grappled with paradox and religious contradiction, wrestled with conformity and dissent, scholarship and faith, engaging the tensions in print as they played within the people themselves.
Good writing,
I think. I'll make us sound a lot better than we were. The press was a gathering place for, well, I'm still on the wrong one, for misfits. With questions, doubts, and concerns, the only security we had was one's innate ability to cope with all of it, relying on our wits, faith, and endurance. Each staff member's experience was unique to their own journey through Mormonism. This is Ernest Strack, also known as Grandpa of Used Books, and one of his many wives.
Not everyone used to.
Actually, that's me. It's not one. Yeah. Just, I couldn't resist. Here are some more misfits. At the press, we were rising to meet raging controversies that relatively few people even seemed to notice at all. Some people thought that the 7th East Press was masterminded by anti-Mormons, but in my memory, we were just earnest, curious BYU students chasing the truth about religion, life, and ourselves. Most of us were changed by the 7th East Press and affected in individual ways that reveal as much about us as the paper. This is why I think the 7th East Press is still compelling today, because it captured a crucial moment in the life of a Mormon and in the life of a community, the loss of innocence. The tree of knowledge, the fall from paradise, rebirth into the real world. For me, it all happened there and then. And in the 20 years since then, I think I've just been processing what happened to me at the press, exploring and expressing the new me endlessly in new ways. The press had its genesis with Ron Pritis, who pictured here looking through a window. A very cultured BYU student. He goes to art galleries. A graduate student in food science, Ron said that most of the real learning at BYU is done after the bell rings and class is dismissed. It happens when a privileged student has a privileged relationship with a professor who knows what's going on in his or her scholarly field. What about the student who doesn't have that kind of relationship? How does he or she know what's going on? I wanted to know, and I think everyone should have that opportunity. That's our Ron. He's an equal opportunity guy. Ron Pritis, along with Anthony Schmidt, an art student, and Robert Schofield, a physics major, founded the BYU Open Door Club and political party, urging BYU students to stand up, shake off the crap, and turn on the light. They published an open door guide to BYU, and Pritis and Schofield ran for office as the ASBYU president and vice president on the open door platform, but they lost by a landslide. Apparently, BYU wasn't ready for open door politics. The Centerpiece Press was a phoenix that rose from the ashes of the open door party. Pritis said that the idea for an independent newspaper came to him in the middle of the night. We're not sure whether it was dressed in white clothing or not. In August 1981, Ron shared his idea at a study group in Provo, where a few graduate students and faculty met on Sunday nights. Sorry, that's really bright. To discuss Mormon history, doctrine, and theology. These are some of the study group members. Well, we keep having the same ones here. Here we are with Ken Cannon, Linda Adams, Gary Bergera. Well, we met to also do a little dancing now and then. Members of the study group jokingly called themselves the Young Swearing Elders. Or was it the New Swearing Elders? I can never remember. This was one of our square dance evenings. That's Ron in his younger days, and Gary Bergera, and that's the back of me over on the left. Here are the New Swearing Elders. Let's see, Albert and Blake Osler on the left. And Linda Adams and Lynn Osler. And Rebecca Hall. Whoops, sorry. I switched off of Rebecca a little too fast. Very beautiful. Switch back to Lynn Osler. This is when Lynn was married to Grandpa. Yeah. She hasn't aged a day, by the way. And Gary, another one of the Young Swearing Elders, and Scott Dunn. Albert Peck, a graduate student in public administration, was excited about the idea and immediately began making plans for the paper, acting as editor himself. And others in the study group agreed to write or help. Anthony agreed to handle the graphics and production. Others in the study group offered to write, including Rebecca Hall, Scott Dunn, Gary Bergera, Blake Osler, Jeff Keller, Scott Fallring, Ken Cannon, Martha Pierce, Maxine Hanks, and a few faculty members who will remain nameless. The Centerpiece Press embodied the interests of the study group, but it also absorbed other student topics along the way. The press printed a mix of breaking news, investigative and feature stories, humor, scholarly articles with footnotes, creative writing, and overall was seen as a kind of intellectual tabloid. Albert made flowcharts, and Ron began writing stories. In late August and early September, the Provo Daily Herald, Salt Lake Tribune, Deseret News, and Daily Utah Chronicle, and after pressure, the BYU Daily Universe, ran a photo of Ron and Albert with a short article about the press. This was the ad that pulled me in. I saw that and I knew I had to be a part of this, whatever it was. I happened to pick up the Daily Herald, the only day I ever looked at the Daily Herald. And honestly, the only day I ever looked at the Daily Herald was this day. And I saw that picture. Ron and Albert looked for an office while assigning writers and finding resources and articles and typesetting all over the phone from various apartments and locations over all over campus, including the Wilkinson Center. They really didn't have a base of operations, so they were just sort of... And this was before cell phones, you know, and computers, so... The project assumed a frantic pace and a life of its own. Ron worried if they would be able to get enough stories or ads to actually put out a paper. But Albert said, when you believe in the cause, you do these things. And so they just did them. And did them, and did them, and did them. Albert interviewed dozens of students, and Ron suggested dozens of story ideas and began writing them, and the two of them wound up doing most of the work to pull the first issue of the paper together, writing, typing, typesetting, and selling ads.
Remember you said, I'll be in the step-down lounge in the foyer?
Yeah, Albert would, he would call people on the phone and say, I understand you want to help with this paper. Meet me in the step-down lounge and I'll be the one in the beret. And so, thanks. Please throw things in and correct me, by the way.
I'll be the one with the pen.
Possible names for the paper ranged from Terms and Semesters to the Provo Expositor to the Crab. According to Elbert, clearer heads prevailed, and an office at 839 North 7th East provided both a name and a home. The first issue finally came together in a grueling all-night paste-up session at the home of Anthony Schmidt, and with the help of Maxine Hanks, a communication major, who wrote the thrills page and showed up ready to do whatever else it takes. On Anthony's glass dining table, Elbert cut and pasted columns, Ron wrote last-minute stories, and Anthony designed layout and ads, and Maxine typed and pasted copy and hand-lettered headlines. We had, Anthony and I hand-lettered those headlines. This is before, I'm so proud of those. It took us, you know, hours. By 3 a.m. when the others began collapsing, I kept pasting on until morning when I finally went out for donuts and came back as those guys were waking up. The all-night paste-up became a routine, and the staff learned to drink a lot of Coca-Cola to stay awake.
This is our first issue.
This was our first issue. On October 6, 1981, the 7th East Press Independent Student Newspaper appeared on BYU campus, ta-da, as an ambitious, somewhat momentous publication. There were 29 issues of the paper between October 1981 and May 1983. A handful of students worked around the clock to produce each issue and launch a season of independent thought and publishing on BYU campus that continued later with the Student Review.
Notice how creatively Anthony made that picture fit.
Yeah. Anthony was a believer in space. He always liked to. He liked the golden mean, and he liked everything to take up about 3/5 of, and then some white space for to have some class. So that's how he laid everything out. All groups and organizations tend to evolve through three phases: a dynamic growth phase, a period of balance and stability, and a fulfillment or realization phase with decline. If an infusion of new people or energy occurs in phase three, it can become a new phase one, and the cycle repeat itself for another round. If not, we see deceleration, final crisis, and demise. It's interesting because I think we see this with Sunstone, too. Just in the last year, it's kind of gone through its third phase, and now with the new infusion of staff, we see Sunstone moving into first phase again to repeat the cycle of an organization, which I think is interesting. The 7th East Press went through these three phases. Phase one saw Ron and Elbert at the helm of a dynamic growth phase. Phase two was a period of balance and stability with Tim Slover and a large, lively staff. Phase three was the completion and realization of the dream, along with the unsettling of the press, with Scott Worley and Dean Huffaker managing controversy, staff erosion, and a decelerating vehicle due to outside pressures. So I'm going to talk about phase one really quick. Issue number one reported Boyd K. Packer's 1981 BYU speech to church historians about writing faithful history, and it established the format of the paper, launching several features and that stayed with the press till the very end. And it did. The paper did keep the same features and basic structure to the very end. It was very consistent. A number of interesting articles, Rain Tree Apartments Require Bishop's Interview, prompted the ACLU into action. We announced our office warming party with popcorn and ice water and pleas for supplies. We had investigative news articles by Ron. We had Woody Allen-type satires by Peter Sorensen, who was asking questions like, will the University of Chicago ever become the John Hopkins of the Midwest? Or UCLA become the Brown University of California? And Stanford have to disguise itself as USC to get into the Rose Bowl? It's a play on the whole, you know, BYU being whatever. I can't even remember, the Harvard of the West, you know, something like that. We had humorous photos by Robert Schofield, our physics and... I like the way he disguised the nuclear family sculpture on campus. There's supposed to be a child there where the garbage is. We had Gray Matter's discussion of Mormon theology and doctrine by Gary Bergera, asking questions like, what is official Mormon doctrine?
And we had some lovely clip art.
And we had lovely clip art. We had an usage column on verbal etiquette by Scott Dunn, a linguistics grad student, and the Thrills Entertainment page should be somewhere. Oh, here's the editorial. Our editorial pages with our 7th East Press staff box. Elbert, of course, wrote editorials each issue. We had the Going My Way humorous column by Dick Townsend, alias Scott Dunn. And we also had personal messages, like, Ron, do your homework, Albert. Dear Fufu, will you reconsider, Ron? To Miss Walquist, my Robert Foss paper is coming, but so is Christmas, A.H. Students actually would run personals all the time in our paper that were pretty funny. Albert's first editorial expressed the shared group vision, probably the only view we all had in common, and the momentum behind the press's first phase, to provide a safe place within the larger context, or BYU community, for an open discussion of ideas, an ideal that propelled us through the first six issues. We wanted to be able to have open campus discussion, an avenue for personal discussion and public opinion. We wanted to provide non-journalism students with an outlet for publishing and writing, and we wanted to create a publication completely independent of the university. Ron Pritis sold his car for $700 to fund the printing of the first issue, so the staff used my car instead.
Maxine?
Here's the Thrills page.
It might be interesting that the reason that Scott went by Dick Townsend was because he worked at BYU Studies.
I mentioned that later.
Oh, I'm
but
sorry.
It's okay, yeah. Dick Townsend was an alias, and I mentioned later why he had to use the alias. There's his Going My Way, Gilgal, A Child's Garden of Sculpture. We have the Joseph Smith Sphinx. This is our momentous first issue. And here's another white space ad of Anthony's that I really enjoy. Sometimes we didn't have any graphics or information, so we just used the title of the advertiser and some white space nicely arranged. It worked really well. We did all of our paste up on a glass table that I found at DI for $2, since we could no longer use Anthony's. Oh, here's our editorial cartoonist, Jim Rex. We had, let's see, our initial print run was 5,000 copies. Oh, there's my car. That's the staff squad car. Since Ron sold his. Our initial print run was 5,000 copies. It took us a semester to get rid of all of them, said Pritis. The press continued to print 5,000 copies per issue. What we didn't sell was used for promotional purposes or to line the bottoms of bird cages across the country. Albert and Ron moved in with a paper to defray costs and lost all their privacy as staff members worked around the clock and people came in and out constantly. I nicknamed the office the fishbowl. All of the furniture and supplies were donated or rented, including our paste-up table from DI. When the county assessed the press for assets, the bill came to $2.52. issue number two. Let's see if we get to... Oh, here we are. Here's Ron and Albert moving in to the office. This is an office above Kinko's Copies, and this building was a triangle, and every room in the building was a triangle. And every space within the apartment was a triangle. Even the closet was a triangle. It was a geometric nightmare. It was the strangest building any of us have ever seen in our lives. And I'm still trying to figure out what it meant. But it was up on the second floor. And there's Ron and Albert's room. So Ron wondered how I got that picture, and I have no idea. Our second issue brought more features, speaking in tongues, foreign language articles. We would publish an article in a foreign language so that the foreign language students could, you know, practice their foreign language skills. We called it speaking in tongues. BYU bureau tape, red tape horror stories, abusage about Mormons homogenizing language with words like prideful and guiltful. Blake Osler's discussion of the challenge of Mormon history, Gray Matters by Gary Brugera, on the church and organic evolution. And I think we have a cartoon here. Why Censorship Not Extreme? And Going My Way went to the LDS Cannery of Paradise. Oh, there are three. Our new regular features included Campus Chatter, which were news tidbits and scandals compiled by Ron. Things like BYU pays $150,000 annually for toilet paper, and Leonard Arrington was turned into standards for wearing a passion purple shirt. So he managed to collect some of the most unusual bits and pieces. Issue number three touted the press's acquisition of the Doonesbury cartoon and a news story by Jeannie Hanks on the Liberty Park Social for ERA and gay activists. So we were off to a controversial start from our first issue and each issue. Gary's Gray Matters was about progression among the Eternal Kingdoms. Lent Tula Pritchett's critique of Reaganomics, Jonathan Skousen was listed as the staff godsend for doing our typesetting. And although Ron did much of the writing, he rarely put his name in the staff box. Ron said if there was any balance to the paper, it was because we canceled each other out in different areas. He said, I was pretty liberal theologically, but politically conservative, while Elbert was just the opposite. Elbert felt that the paper should look conservative so the stories could be more daring, kind of, you know, take the students by surprise. I joked that the importance of each story was inversely proportional to the size and controversy of its headline. Here's our BYU mascot. And we were so serious about this effort that Elbert went and got a bunch of newsstands and went out and painted them, and we put newsstands around town. We wanted people to buy our paper. And I'm not sure if I mentioned that the price was 5 cents. Was it? Oh, was it 10 cents? Okay. Here's Ron Prittis's ambitious reporting of Mormon leftists and conservatives clashing in Central America brought him a lot of praise for that article. He also was running around selling ads and writing stories, and this was one of his moments of brief rest between stories. Johnson Tittle's was a satire of the Hill Cumorah pageant, and Elbert began writing a series of strenuous editorials on student government. Here's Ron's article also about, more leftists and conservatives clashing in Central America. Issue number 5, let's see, this is still issue number 4. Issue number 5 reported Provo's Lost It Party, a Seventh East Press staff satire of Provo City's PR campaign, Provo's Got It, Get It. We had decided to have a party and feature entertainment by Maxine Hanks and the Losers, which was a blues band. We had polyester suits, blues songs, and warm lime Kool-Aid was served for refreshments. This issue was interesting. Elbert interviewed Arthur Henry King, I think, in this issue. And Ron wrote an article on the development of the garment. And Gary's Gray Matters dealt with church views on human sexuality. So as you can see, we were keeping it. Oh, here's the Provo's Lost It Party with Maxine and the Losers. Providing entertainment. It was just, I got together a couple of friends who were musicians, and we, here's Elbert in the triangular kitchen. The bathroom was a triangle, too. It was amazing. In issue 6, Bruce McConkie rebuked religion professor George Pace and the practice of praying to Christ. Ron happened to approach McConkie right after his speech to get a quote, just as McConkie was joking with a Universe reporter that the Seventh East Press had likely stolen his press release. And Ron let him know that we didn't steal it. I guess it took Elder McConkie by surprise. We also had a report of Mike Quinn's response to Boyd K. Packer's admonition for a faithful history. And our report about Mike Quinn responding... historian response to apostle. That was picked up by Newsweek and wound up being an article with a photo of Mike Quinn in Newsweek. So we got the story, and Newsweek got it from us. We were pretty excited. We also included Scott Dunn's anonymous interview with himself about the Mormon document underground. We had some creative reporting at the press. It was interesting. Scott happened to work for BYU Studies, and so he had to use pseudonyms or write anonymously. We had a report of a BYU State fireside discouraging young marrieds from using birth control, and we had Gary's LDS responses to sex education in the schools, and Dick Townsend's review of A Greasy Spoon. There's Dick Townsend, hard at work, on the trail of A Greasy Spoon. Here's our graffiti wall. As each issue progressed, we would paste interesting graphics and photos on this wall, and it began to be quite a work of art. Issues number 6 through 15 showed our energetic attempts to meet controversy and conflict rather than shun it, as we felt the church and BYU did. But none of us seemed prepared for the ways in which that conflict would affect us personally. I'm going to start speeding up because I want to leave plenty of time for, I don't know what time it is. Issue number 7 featured Professor Alan Keel's humanist view of university athletics, together with an unflattering photo of a BYU basketball player, which Ron and I pasted in while Albert was away. It was one of our many attempts to offset his conservative editorial control. Ron and I attempted solidarity from time to time, but Albert would sometimes get the best of us and have his way. The Johnson Tittle satire in this issue was a satire of Joseph Fielding Smith's Truth and Wisdom for $9.95. Gary ran excerpts of the B.H. Roberts' The Truth, the Way, and the Life in this issue, which Albert said he later regretted printing because of the negative feedback he received, and yet this was a really, really important publishing of this work. Gary's Gray Matters also dealt with Gerald and Sandra Tanner, letting people know about the Tanners and their publishing, which a lot of us have never heard of before. We were often seen as being intellectual and controversial, and more professors than students seemed to respond to the paper. Although we got responses from everybody, including advertisers, readers, the religion department at BYU, and our landlord. A BYU employee contacted the owner of Kinko's building to complain about the shoddy tenants, meaning us. And most of our parents thought we'd lost our mind and pressured us to quit the paper and finish our degrees or go get real jobs, since none of us were making any money on the paper. One parent called the paper a scurrilous rag, and another parent referred to his son as a Mario Savio. Some religion professors repeatedly warned students about us, and we continued to confront issues and found ourselves in a microcosm of the tensions colliding in Mormonism. And Albert always saw himself walking a fine balance, even on the staircase outside the office. Ron's research on social clubs at BYU led to a chapter later in his book with Gary Bergera, BYU, A House of Faith. Gary's interview with Peggy Fletcher at Sunstone opened Sunstone to a lot of students at BYU. That was a very interesting interview that we ran with her. I think it was called Always a Little Hungry. We had a report on Mormon fundamentalism and Albert's editorial about social clubs at BYU. And Gary Bergera confronted Brigham Young and the Adam God theory in his Gray Matters. There we have our cartoon with suggestions for what to do with the new business building. As a skeleton crew of overworked full-time staff, assisted by a variety of students wandering in and out of the office, we were amazed by what we had taken on, and we were prone to expect too much of ourselves. Controversy plagued us constantly, while compliments and complaints came from all quarters. A constant stream of people flowed through the office as we tried to work. People either came to praise us, or investigate us, or gawk at us, or tell us off. We were so focused on the cause and our own discoveries, we didn't even realize that we would get reactions. We soon discovered that we were as popular off-campus in other cities and states as we were at BYU. BYU Studies requested that its interns not write for the Seventh East Press, so Gary stopped writing Gray Matters at this point, but helped in other ways. And Scott continued to write under the pseudonym Dick Townsend. Many people wanted to take assignments for the paper, but they were too intimidated to pursue or complete them. Ron felt that one of the most difficult aspects of keeping the paper going was convincing merchants to purchase advertising. Here are some more of our ads. Oops. I think I got that one backwards, sorry. Several students tried to sell ads and never returned. We'd send them out and they'd never come back. It was a tough job selling ads for this underground paper in Provo. So I began selling the ads and never got out of the job. Ads were designed at midnight, cut out from the Universe and other papers. We basically lifted them, stole them, and stuck them in. Or we pulled them from garbage cans. Albert and Ron exhausted themselves around the clock. Ron was grinding out investigative stories and articles for every issue while also doing typesetting and trying to keep his yogurt business going and selling ads out on his bike. I often worried about him collapsing. Here we are dancing again, taking another dance break. Okay, I'm going to try to skip through some stuff because I want to get to our panelists. Ron said the trick to funding the press was knowing which checks to bounce and when. Unfortunately, many of them bounced uncontrollably. We routinely collected about $500 from sales and a constant trickle of subscriptions from 40 states and even a few foreign countries. Donations came from businessmen, such as One man who gave us $1,000 in exchange for a copy of Rodney Turner's master's thesis on the Adam-God theory. And we came up with some creative financing for the paper. And we got donations from over 200 BYU professors and alumni. We also received a couple of donations from a very shadowy figure in San Francisco. Over Christmas, we all took a break, and some staff members decided to start reading the Tanners, Mormonism, Shadow, or Reality, which further demonstrated to us that all was not well in Zion. In issue number 9, Scott Dunn scooped the Xerox theft of Kelly, of Andy Ehat's copy of the William Clayton Diaries. Very complex bit of intrigue going on campus. We also raised the price of our paper to 25 cents, hoping to make a little more money. I'm going to skip through some of this because I want to... Scott Farling reported in Gray Matter. He was now doing Gray Matter since Gary couldn't write for the press, at least by name. And he commented on Joseph Smith's various accounts of the first vision. Dick Townsend took a trip to the church office building on plexiglass wings. And issue number 10, we have Albert's review of research at BYU. And Peter Sorensen's Jots and Tittles was a satire of Dick Paul's Iron Rotters and Liahonas entitled Flannel Boards and Flip Charts. Albert's editorial assessed the state of the press, and this signaled the beginning of the transition from stage one into stage two, group stability. Albert's editorial said, the paper is becoming a forum for discussion, and the level of conversation on campus has been raised. So we were just beginning into phase two. Meanwhile, individually, we were beginning to lose some of our trust and faith in the corporate church. We were living in a crucible of stress, along with some disillusionment, and we were learning things like that there were spies watching us, and we even heard that our phone was being tapped at times. Ron increasingly wanted to confront controversial issues and air them publicly and deal with them, letting people know the truth, while Albert sometimes saw himself wanting to strike a balance between enlightenment and dissent, or conservatism and dissent. Ron and Albert began to pull in different directions on this more and more. And on top of working endless hours and the ideological stresses we were encountering, we had no income, and we survived for months on pancakes, ice cream, and baked potatoes, prepared by Ron from his parents' food supply, and also by pooling our meager resources. Albert wanted to publish weekly, but we averaged about 3 papers per month. The pitfalls of publishing by hand without word processors produced a multitude of typos. We had some great typos. A couple of them were, here are a couple I'll read. We'd like to become professional writers. That's ludicrous. Another one was proof reading the Book of Moses instead of proof texting. And then a letter to the editor urged that we should be developing a personal revolution in South America. Albert's editorial on honest church history condemned the methods used by members of the Mormon underground and supported Elder Packer's advocation of a spiritual history, yet it also denounced the notion of spiritual supermen. Needless to say, Ron and I were a bit unhappy with this, with the editorial. We often disagreed with Albert, but it was nice because we had an interesting balance between the three of us. Scott Falmering reviewed the Book of Abraham controversy, and Dick Townsend visited a blood bank, which he found to be a very draining experience. I can't remember why I put this in here. I think we were starting to go stir crazy, and this is an example of that. Me kissing my cat. Ron's starting to lift his head a little. Now, is this issue 12? Let's see. I think I'm off. Inspiring. Yeah, I think I'm a little bit behind here. Oh, well, anyway. This is the one with the editorial, I think, that we didn't like. Yeah, here we go. This was Albert's editorial on church history. And this issue, number 12, both reported and displayed dissent at BYU. Ron's article here dealt with dissent, and we covered a report of student protests of BYU's Military Week and General Westmoreland's visit. We ran an editorial to Bring Back Beards, and Gary reviewed the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So we had a heck of an issue. I should back up a little. We also were increasing our promotion of causes like Amnesty International. Issue 13, Ron's article on the Wilkinson spy ring gathered much praise and later became another chapter in his book on BYU. We reported the closing of the LDS Church archives and the release of church historian Leonard Arrington in this issue, which became a really important... The paper was an important outlet for that kind of information. We also had a notice of a peace symposium at BYU coming to offset Military Week that several of us on the staff were involved in. In addition to doing the paper, we were promoting causes on the side, so I guess we saw ourselves as the do-gooders on campus who had to kind of run around and do all these kinds of things. Albert's editorial chastised Bruce R. McConkie's uncharitable rebuke of religion professor George Pace. Albert's father was so upset about this, he requested that Albert apologize to Elder McConkie personally. Jim Rex's cartoon depicted a BYU student. Oh, wait. Let's see, I'm a little bit off. Oh, this is, again, Ron's story on the spy ring was covered. Is this Utah Holiday?
It's certainly.
Yes, Paul Swenson, I think. Were you involved with this article? So this was another article that we did that was picked up and got visibility in other publications. Here's some of our controversial causes we're promoting on my Thrills page. Stop MX. Hair, the musical. Okay, and here we have a BYU student who's praying and is confused. Now, who do I pray to? Albert began to wonder if he was doing the right thing and began to regret that maybe he was, in doing this newspaper, maybe he was doing the wrong thing. But I kept assuring him that I felt we were doing the right thing with this paper. In issue number 14, Dean Huffaker was one of our reporters who came in around this time, and he wrote about homosexuality at BYU, revealing a gay underground. Eloise Bell, we printed her speech on single women in a very married church, and Albert's editorial pleaded for many causes, good causes. In issue number 15, Dean Huffaker's conclusion, oh, here's one of our ads here. Another Thrills page and our cutout photographs with humorous captions. This one, I don't know if I can read the caption. Sheesh, you'd think the religion faculty could drive in cars to campus like everyone else. We've got angels and chariots. Okay. Here we go. Huffaker's conclusion to homosexuality at BYU Part 2 revealed BYU's use of shock therapy on gay students and BYU security surveillance practices. We also ran a personal essay, Why I Became a Homosexual by a Returned LDS Missionary. That was the title. Is that what? Yeah, there we go. I'm amazed these are matching this text. We also ran reports of the peace symposium that we had promoted ourselves. So we were promoting these causes, and then we were reporting on them in the next issue. It was a nice balance. Yeah, we kind of, kept it all going. Ken Cannon wrote about development of the doctrine of the Holy Ghost, and Elvis' disillusionment with the paper was growing, and he wrote an editorial about it called Why Unblooms the Best Hope Ever Sown. The pressures, midway through the production of this issue, the pressures and the tensions were starting to get to him. Understandably, and he defected and went to the Sunstone Review, and he left a note that said he'd gone to Salt Lake and was available for consultation, but he would not be returning. Ron and I were in shock because we were in the middle of an issue and we'd never done the paper without Albert, and I remember Ron saying, well, that's it, Max, we can't do it, it's over. And I said, well, if we can just get through this issue, then we can make it to the next one, and I think we can do it. So we kept each other awake all night for 3 nights of paste up, and we got through the issue and got it done. The stress that drove Albert away continued to plague those of us who stayed. Ron remained determined to meet conflict and discuss controversial issues, while I began to feel torn between the desire for honesty and a concern for propriety. As I saw it, the greatest challenge of staff membership at the press was that in challenging the honesty of the church and the integrity of BYU, we were also confronted by our own ability to be honest with ourselves. During spring break, Ron and I discovered that people had been vandalizing our newspaper stands around town. And this was the kind of thing we encountered. I mean, we were constantly encountering negative feedback. Ron suggested that I become editor, and I suggested that he become editor, and neither one of us wanted to be editor. So we tried to talk Gary and Scott into becoming editor, and they didn't want to become editor. So we decided to take a break and go to the MHA and think about it later. So this was our trip to the MHA. And I think George Smith snapped this picture. Fun times. Several faculty recommended Tim Slover for the position of editor, and he was a PhD candidate in dramatic literature at Penn State. At first he was hesitant, but later he said that working at the press gave him the same exhilaration he found appearing on stage. There's Tim Slover. So he accepted the position with a lot of arm twisting, and with the beginning of spring term came the successful passage to the second phase. Here's our staff list. We got a new editor and an enthusiastic new staff. A whole rush of new people came in, including Kent Appleberry, a BYU Archives employee, and Lisa Barlow, a real live journalism major, and Larry Hollis, who had actually worked for a daily paper in Texas. At this point, our common goal was stability and maintaining our status quo of publishing. We became firmly grounded in the second phase of group evolution, where we became very stable and had a very strong paper. Under Tim Slover, the staff was confident, and the paper was more stable, and the quality was balanced. Staff members began to relax and actually have fun. Some even went hiking, and Ron was able to finally lift his head a little. Here we have a couple of staff members goofing off. Our cartoonist and one of our writers. And starting with issue 16, Jonathan Skousen gave the paper a whole new masthead and design, using the street sign concept. Tim said, some people had complained that the old design made them dizzy. Now when people get sick, they have to find some other excuse. We covered a men's conference at the U of U in reaction to BYU's women's conference. I'm skipping through. There's so much here, and I've got to get through this. Tim's first editorial, entitled The Straight and the Narrow, responded to the wave of controversy following our articles on homosexuality and advocated an open-minded acceptance of homosexuals while classifying homosexual activity as a sin. Jeff Keller's doctrinal discussion of when the spirit enters the body was printed, and we had a Cougar Stadium cartoon. And we also reported on the MHA, which featured Mark Hoffman's discovery of the Joseph Smith III blessing, or what we thought was the Joseph Smith III. Was it really? okay. 17, we covered the Anti-Mormon Conference at Alta and Ron's evaluation of the philosophy department, Gary's interview with Mary Bradford, and Tim's editorial on the arts and the church. And Elder Kessler reading Debbie's diary in the cartoons. In 18, we had Kent's story on ASBYU Women's Office, and we interviewed Hal Black on sociobiology. We also had a report on farms, and a reprint of Ken Woodward's proposal to abolish the College of Business Administration. That's me interviewing Olive Osmond at Marie's wedding. I just had to cover Marie Osmond's wedding reception. I don't know why. Little did Olive know she was going to end up in a scurrilous rag. Here's our editorial page. I can't begin to really express all of the sort of the negative stresses we were dealing with each issue, but it didn't stop us. We were driven. In 1980, Ross wrote an expose on the Cougar Stadium and the selling off to the rich. We also had Rodney Turner's speech about higher education being hazardous to women, and Orson Scott Card's notes from a guardian angel. In the next issue, we had Ron's assessment of BYU Education Week, which was not, you know, particularly flattering, and Tim's critique of the church's attitude toward women. We also had interviews with political candidates. This was our anniversary double issue, reprinting the best of Seventh East Press and a humorous retrospective of the press's first year. A scoop in this issue was the first-time printing of Mark Kaufman's Lucy Mack Smith letter. I think this double issue was hard evidence of the press's stability. Still, we had a lot of strains from the previous phase, and other tensions were growing. Certain staff members didn't get along because of different personalities. Kent and Lisa, or Ron or I, or others would find ourselves on opposite sides of some editorial decisions. And Tim saw himself as a referee as much as an editor. He also found it necessary to reject some articles. He felt that Dick Townsend's Going My Way visit to a sperm bank just wasn't appropriate. And he also rejected a photo essay of General Authority's homes. Here are two staff members, Steve Nelson and Sissy Warner. Steve Nelson, photographer, and Sissy Warner, a journalism major. This is some of our art on the walls. Here's Tim as the referee, the three Tims, trying to find balance with the staff. These were some of the faces he used in trying to solve conflicts. We also welcome Jennifer Treff, who was the accountant and business manager for the staff. At the end of this issue in the summer, we decided to take a break and go to Sunstone. So here's the Seventh East Press at our first Sunstone symposium together. And I think this was 1982, right? August 82.
Hotel Utah.
At the old Hotel Utah, right. And that's Scott Dunn, Jean Marie Todd, me on the right, Gary Bergera, Ron, Rebecca Hall, and Larry Hollis. When summer ended, Tim slowly returned to Michigan, leaving us bereft of an editor. Ron tried to persuade me, or Scott, or Kent, and we tried to persuade Ron, but none of us were willing to become editor. We finally talked Scott Woolley, a University of Chicago law student, into being the new editor. And English major and author of the homosexuality series, Dean Heffiger, agreed to manage production. This transition signaled the beginning of Phase 3. Here's Scott Woolley. Phase 3, the realization and fulfillment, the testing, crisis, and decline. Increasing attacks from the outside and schisms within, along with a growing sense of isolation, strained our stability. External pressures from BYU and the church persisted, eventually causing the press's demise. Ironically, at this time, our tax-exempt nonprofit corporation status was finally granted by the IRS after over a year. And the Board of Trustees, this was... Oh, this is actually a little out of place, but I'll come back to it. Anyway, in Volume 2, Number 1, Ron and Gary's lead article offered a closer look at the president, Jeff Holland, which took a critical view of his administration. And Jeff Keller wrote about Mark Kaufman making a buck off church history, long before, you know, we knew what was really going on with Hoffman. I'm going to skip through some of this because I want to get through. In the next issue, here is some of our Mormonism and Masonry. Here's Dean Huffaker and Phil Todd working in the office.
You had a computer by then.
Typesetting. We were doing typesetting on a computer. Dean Huffaker exposed BYU Cougar Stadium in this issue. A construction accident that happened, and Gary Bergera returned to writing Gray Matters, and Robert Schofield and his prankish work gave us a pre-Columbian eight ball, Purpose Unknown, at the Joseph Filling Smith. We weren't sure about that. Let's see. This issue, Scott Dunn affectionately referred to as a hell of an issue. It featured Dean's article on the occult and Gary's Gray Matters on the office of the church patriarch, revealing that the last patriarch to the church may have been released partly due to a personal struggle with homosexuality. And also Scott Woolley left us, returning to Chicago and to school, leaving us without an editor. Ron and I tried one last time to talk each other into it and refused to be editor, so we persuaded Dean Huffaker. The staff retained some momentum and stability, and a very fun group of people continued to put out each issue of the paper, including Dean and Sissy, Jennifer Treff, Steve Nelson, Phil Todd, all very enthusiastic. At this point, Ron and I were starting to tire, and fatigue was starting to set in for us. Oh, here's Scott Woolley leaving. Here's Ron starting to crawl off that car now. He's wanting to move on to bigger and better things. And there's Gary. Ron was beginning to write a book about BYU with Gary Bergera, and I was feeling torn about needing to move on and actually make some money so I could pay my rent. Dean sometimes found himself alone in the office. In his first issue as editor, Dean printed Blake Osler's infamous interview with Sterling McMurrin. What a way to start your editorship, right? In which McMurrin said, among other intriguing things, "People don't get books from angels." Dean's editorial responded to attacks on the press by stating that we view external criticism as a healthy tool for self-evaluation and self-improvement. What an evolved perspective. I think I've only recently come to that point myself. Here's our staff list with Dean Huffaker as managing editor, keeping the whole thing going. Gary's Gray Matters in this issue discussed the Adam God theory, while Dean's editorial was hauntingly lighthearted, entitled "What Me Worry?" It was an accidentally accurate prediction of what was to come. Here was the infamous Sterling McMurrin interview that got us into quite a bit of trouble. This was the momentous and transitional issue for us, signaling the end. On February 9th, Dean Huffaker was contacted by Paul Richards of BYU Public Relations, who asked to meet him in the Cougar Eat. Over a cup of yogurt, Richards explained that the Seventh East Press was being banned from campus, meaning it could not be sold on campus, nor could anyone on campus purchase advertising in the press. Dean came back to the office in a daze, then called an emergency staff meeting to discuss the ban. We knew this was a fatal blow to the press. Without campus distribution and affiliation, our role in the BYU community would dissolve. Without ads purchased by ASBYU and campus departments, our revenues were meager. We were in serious trouble. And they knew that this would put us in serious trouble. Staff members felt personally attacked and anxious, and Sissy Warner wrote an editorial, "Will the ban roll on?" Ron and I were ready to let the press die a natural death, I think, but this administrative assault left us all feeling we should not go out without a whimper. We notified the wire services and local with a whimper, sorry. We should not go out with a whimper. We notified the wire services and local media and prepared for the resulting media event. Reactions were immediate and scathing. Oops, here we are. Okay. I'm a little bit behind here. Here's the editorial, "What Me Worry?" And this is our cartoon about BYU after we were notified that we were banned. Dean and Phil in the office. Newspaper and magazine editors condemned the banning of the Seventh East Press. Professors protested it as an attack on freedom of speech. Local TV stations and wire services interviewed Dean, and Tim Kelly of the Denver Post canceled his visit to BYU in protest of the ban, sparking controversy, and speaking instead at the U of U. Jeff Holland asked the university dean's counsel, "How in the world did we get into this mess?" Here's some of the coverage. He canceled his speaking engagement and went to the U to speak. Tim Kelly, here we are. Dean suddenly became an overnight star and symbol of student freedom of speech. This is a cartoon we put up on the wall during this time. I don't remember where this came from. This chronicled the ban. Our sentiments about banning. Here are just a few of the articles that we're collecting, piling up. This was actually a photograph of Tim Slover, I think, but it just seemed to fit right there. And here's Gary feeling banned. Here are some staff member reactions. Here's Stephen. We were all pretty depressed. There's Sissy looking unhappy. And I've got serious attitude now.
Serious makeup.
Serious makeup. And here's an issue of the press being used to line the bottom of a birdcage, which was what we saw our future as being. So it was then that Dean struck upon a cunning plan. In the fatigue of working night and day and trying to decide what to do about the ban, it occurred to him. See, here's his cunning, the idea has come. It occurred to him to do a parody of the Daily Universe. Whoops. And if you can flip the lights on, I'm going to switch. I just have 5 or 6 more slides left and we're done. Oh, thanks. And if you don't mind putting this one on, and thank you. We'll continue with our slideshow. I'm worried about time. Oh, we're okay. Stop. Half hour. So where we left off, Dean had a cunning plan. Okay, let's see if we got it. He decided to do a parody of the Daily Universe. Fueled by frustration with BYU and the church, we pulled together this parody issue of the Daily Universe in a matter of weeks. We vented months of frustration, lampooning everything on BYU campus, from censorship to the Board of Trustees, the missionary program, BYU administration, housing, sports, campus security, the honor code, Deseret Book, the military. We even mocked the ban of the press with a fictitious ban on shoe mirrors. Equating the press with shoe mirrors. We labored over graphics to make our parody a convincing replica of BYU's Daily Universe. And this really was Dean's brainchild here.
It was so convincing that if you look at the Daily Universe on microfilm, it's on the microfilm.
Really? Oh, I've got to repeat that for the mic. Gary says it was so convincing it wound up on the microfilm of the BYU Daily Universe. Really? It is there? That's amazing. Here are some of our ads and our news story, our fictitious news stories. Instead of Frank Arnold, we have Barnold demands release, and he's got the shoe phone. That's a satire of the coach of BYU athletics. And security foils escape is, you know, that's the greenhouse. BYU security has nabbed those green plants and not allowed them to escape the greenhouse. And anyway, all of our ads were satires. We were pretty rude. And this was one of my favorites. This was stranded in a phone booth. We've got stranded, never be without your BYIUD. And we were as irreverent as we dared be. Let's see.
Dean points out they're advertising BYU spy rings.
Yes, we have. That's on another page. Here, I think that's on an upcoming page. Here's our commentary page. We wrote an editorial by having every staff member sit down and write one sentence and putting all of our sentences together, and that was our satire of the BYU editorial. And then we had editorials about people not stepping on the grass at BYU. Grass destroyers, they'll get theirs. And about the signs that BYU security would... We had the satire that BYU would plant landmines on the grass so that if any students walked on the grass, they would get hit by a landmine. And the signs, instead of saying, don't walk on the grass, the signs would say, I wouldn't walk here if I were you. But anyway, the Universe parody was a direct hit. Early in the morning of April 1st, 1983, we distributed thousands of copies on BYU campus in Universe newsstands, Daily Universe newsstands, so that people would come to get their Daily Universe and our paper would be there. We took out the Daily Universe and put ours in the newsstand. Where students and faculty all over campus unwittingly picked up copies of our satire. While some white students didn't notice the difference at all, others... I'm serious. Others began laughing out loud, hysterically. As soon as And as soon as the Daily Universe staff discovered our prank a few hours later, they confiscated and destroyed hundreds of copies. Over the protests of dozens of white professors and students who were frantically trying to snag a copy before the press, the Universe could take them away. 20 years later, people still ask me for copies. Here are some more of our ads. Shoe mirrors. I should be up here trying to... BYU endows chairs, stools too. Everything okay at BYU. Anyway, let's see if we've got another page here. Anyway, that was that was the whole paper. I've got the whole layout here. So you've got every page of the satire here in print. I like this article, Pope Finds Truth, about the missionaries being successful at finally converting the Pope. Anyway. This was our way of responding to the banning. Okay, we're down to the end here. Volume 2, number 7, our last issue, was anticlimactic, announcing the demise of the press as a change in name and editor rather than as the death of the paper. Those who wanted to stay could work for a new paper called the University Post, edited by journalism major Rod Wagner. Few staff members wanted to continue under the new arrangement. Rod had inherited a banned press and had no one to sell ads. In spite of some private funding, his paper lasted for 2 issues due to the effects of the ban. In retrospect, here's our last issue. And I don't know what
we
this...
We just learned that they had a grant of $60,000.
Yeah. This says, gee, this job as church historian is turning out to be easier than I thought, and it's a huge book burning. Yeah, we only recently found out, a BYU student did a research paper on the Seventh East Press, and in his research and his report, we found out things we didn't know, that the paper that succeeded us had something like a $60,000 grant, and we had nothing. We were working on pennies, and he folded after 2 issues, and we went for 2 years just on mashed potatoes and corn. What's that?
Who gave the grant?
We don't know. Do we know that? No, we don't know that. And here was our farewell photo of the group in the Tree of Knowledge sculpture. Our farewell. In retrospect, why did the press die? Overwhelming stress outside and in during the third phase of the organizational cycle. First, the ban removed campus support and advertising dollars. Second, the course staff needed to move on and there was not a new group to fill their shoes. Third, we continually offered dissenting views in an environment that simply wanted conformity. Fourth, the articles on the Office of the Patriarch, homosexuality at BYU, and the Sterling McMurrin interview especially irritated President Ezra Taft Benson. Sources told us that President Benson had been pressuring the BYU administration, Jeff Holland, for months to get rid of that paper, quote unquote. Reportedly, Holland had acted as a buffer for a long time, resisting pressure until Benson finally gave him an ultimatum, which resulted in the ban. Ironically, out of 29 issues, the Seventh East Press only had 4 that generated the controversial articles. Our final effort as a staff was a funeral wake in May 1983. Oh, here are a couple more articles about the new paper. And again, that was from Utah Holiday. Paul Swenson, right. It's interesting. We've got Dean Huffaker and Benson and then the new editor. Whenever we were reported on, it was interesting, the collection of photos. You know, you'd have Wilkinson and then Ron and Gary, you know. Here we have Dean and President Benson and Rod Wagner. Anyway, our funeral wake included food, slides, music, and a casket full of Seventh East Press issues, which unfortunately I never got a picture of. But we actually got a casket and filled it with issues of the press. We gave out our best and worst awards, which included the worst headlines and the best headlines, the worst stories and the best stories, the most offensive ads, and etc. Although our independent paper did not last, the impact of the Seventh East Press did not end in 1983, but continued in the lives of its staff members. The press was a remarkable convergence of individuals, many of whom went on to take key roles in Mormon studies. Continuing to write, continuing to publish heretical, unorthodox, unpopular texts. Other contributors of the Seventh East Press went on to professional careers, still retaining the lessons that they learned, forever changed by the press. There we go. Isn't that nice? That's all it's like. Thank you. Okay, if our panelists will come up, I'll quickly introduce you, and I'll stop talking and give you guys the last half hour, 20 minutes, which doesn't give you much time. We have Ron Prittis, the Seventh East Press co-founder, co-publisher, trustee, starving writer, revealer of BYU secrets, returned missionary who was converted to a more expansive view of religious and ethical diversity by the Swiss. He's now the managing director at Signature Books. Anthony Schmidt, Seventh East Press, and if you want to sit in whatever order, I guess. Anthony Schmidt is the co-founder with Ron Prittis. They worked on the Open Door Club, the Open Door Guide, and were our two founders of Seventh East Press. Artist, designer. He said the paper had to look right, even if it meant digging in an advertiser's dumpster at midnight to find a logo. A returned missionary with the haircut, it seemed, for a couple of years afterwards. He's now an assemblage artist and art dealer in Los Angeles who still art directs just about anything, having gone from Weinstocks in Salt Lake to Barney's in New York to O'Connor Associates in Philadelphia, and also spends time in his studio in Santa Monica, California, named after his two grandmas, Adelaide and Euphemia. Did I say that right? Adelaide and Euphemia. Then we have me. You already know me, Maxine Hanks, Seventh East Press co-founding staff member. Now I'm a published author, and Gary Bergera, co-founding staff member, writer, trustee, purveyor of gray matters, devil's advocate with a sensitive soul, returned missionary with impeccable French, who always claimed, basically, I'm a boring person. He's now director of Smith Pettit Foundation. And Dean Huffaker, Seventh East Press editor, writer, slave, symbol of free speech, accidental celebrity, handsome skier dude, lover of brew, and English student. He's now married, a father of two, an instructor. Which college was it you were teaching in California?
I taught at three community colleges on the same day.
in Colorado Springs?
In Denver.
Yeah. And he's now a technology writer. I'm going to turn this over to, I guess, Ron and Anthony first.
Anthony first.
Take 5 or 10 or
20. 5. How I met Ron, after my mission, I went to BYU and moved into a little house. I don't remember the address, do you? And I arrived on campus 2 weeks early, and he was hanging out there about to move. And we spent 2 weeks talking to each other about our opinions on most everything, and I saw us in two completely different places. I think it's more interesting that 20 years later, I feel like I'm more in the place that he wanted to be, and he kind of pursued, you know, what I always wanted. You know, after that summer, we got together and did this book, An Open Door Guide to BYU, and there were some things going on with the Daily Universe, and I know that when he talked to me about, you know, the idea of having a paper, I thought it was a great idea, because I didn't think that there was a voice that, you know, was the voice of the students. It was kind of like, you know, being monitored, and you could talk about this, and you couldn't talk about that kind of a thing. And I remember, well, now I know why the paper got done, because I pasted it up, and these guys were all out taking pictures. it was a really great experience. I enjoyed this group of people to be associated with and you know, see what was out there for my life, and definitely had an impact on pursuing, you know, what was important to me.
Tell us about when you crashed and burned and your day on the mountain.
Oh, my day on the mountain. Well, this was before issue 14. And I was engaged, and I was under a lot of pressure at the time with the newspaper and school and what being engaged meant, and so I decided the thing to do would climb to the top of the Y and kneel down and say a prayer. And so I had no idea what direction or where I was going, or, you know, and so I climbed to the top of the Y during a snowstorm, and I couldn't see BYU when I got up there, and I knelt down and I prayed for quite a while, and when I was finished with the prayer, I opened my eyes and the storm had gone away and I could see BYU, and I knew it was time to leave. So I got an apartment in Salt Lake with Albert, just to kind of, you know, explore what was next for me, and that's that.
I don't know what to add. Maybe during questions and answers, it was, you know, I came into this not having any answers. I had a lot of questions, and so I was thinking later, I had never heard about the Book of Abraham controversy, you know, things like that, and so we were discovering those things as we went, and I had read Great Basin Kingdom was the only Mormon history I had read to that point, except for, you know, Joseph Fielding Smith and Cleon Skousen and a little bit of Nibley and Hiram Andrus. So so that was an amazing time for us. We were, I think, most of us still interested in campus controversies, you know, and student government issues and so on. And but there were those on the staff who knew something otherwise, you know, about history and so on. And so so every issue was a new topic that, you know, just our minds were just turned inside out and upside down. So Albert has said that he left the press because people were losing their testimony. And we've joked about that because we thought he was way ahead of us, you know, on questioning issues and so forth. And in fact, we were typesetting an issue of the paper, and he had written an editorial in which he had just had it, and he had scathing things to say about church leaders and BYU administrators, and Maxine and I objected and wanted to take out some of the adjectives and so forth. And so we had this knockdown dragout. And he finally left the typesetter's office, and knowing that we would tone down, you know, the editorial. And when we got back to the office, that's when we found the note from him that he had packed everything up and left. So it was very hard for everybody. And we had a lot of people who came and went and couldn't take the, you know, the pressure, or, and everybody had this kind of internal crisis going on. And so anyway, I guess that's what I have to say for now.
You come later.
I want to go in or chronological order.
This is a real awkward situation to be in. It's, and I have such mixed feelings about it, because on the one hand, the 70s Press was such an exciting time for me, and I really don't have any. I only have positive memories about my experience with the 70s Press. Lots of gaps in those memories where I don't remember anything, but but the things that I do remember are all very positive. And so it was enjoyable to watch, to see the pictures that would trigger certain memories. But on the other hand, you know, it's hard for me to imagine anybody else is that interested in this, because it was so long ago, and how do you relate to something like this? So that's why, you know, I just worry that it might be interesting for me, but I imagine that, you know, I can't imagine that anybody else is that interested in it.
You mean you still think you're boring?
I still think I'm basically boring at you know, at heart. The one of the things that I think was frustrating after the 70s Press was banned, and as other student newspapers came on the scene, there was a perception that the Seventh East Press somehow had deserved the banning, that it had done things that it wasn't supposed to do, had been told not to do, and therefore this was a justified punishment. And it was hard to explain to people that we had tried repeatedly to talk to BYU administrators about what their reaction was to the Seventh East Press. Did they have any suggestions for improvement, anything like that? So it was a surprise. There had been no indication up to that point that there were the problems that they felt the Seventh East Press was generating were that serious. And that was a real frustrating thing to be confronted with. And the fact that the Seventh East Press ran the interview with Sterling McMurrin is, you know, that was never that convincing to me, because Dialogue ran it a year later and they got to stay on campus. They stayed in the bookstore. I think it had something to do with just the fact that this was an independent student newspaper, and there was something so threatening about that that it couldn't be controlled. That here was this independent voice that really couldn't be controlled. You know, there weren't any standards violators that they knew of, or that we knew of, really, yet. And so there wasn't that. You know, it was just your thinking and your speaking and your writing. And that must have been one of the hard things. Paul Richards has since apologized to us for having been the spokesperson and having been in that situation of doing something that he personally disagreed with. And I know that was a very hard thing for him. And hopefully he's over it. But
we are.
You know, yeah. It was. I guess that's what I'd like to leave with. It was an exciting time for me. Such a memorable. It's a warm, fuzzy time for me. That's basically what it was.
Can I say one more thing?
No.
Okay, real quick. I won't take much. No, I agree in the sense that it was at such a time of what we were loving doing and talking about. And one of the things too, you know, as far as I can accurate, you know, when you grow up, you know, my dad was the bishop of our ward for nearly 10 years, it seems like, and the whole thing about truth, you know. And when I look back on, you know, like things about BYU, I realize that my version of what happened at that time holds some truth to it in all of our versions. And my most surprising was when I read something about the protest about the washing machines at Callis Hall. You know, it tells a story of, you know, what happened. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm the one that painted that banner and hung it on the bell tower. You know, and that's not what happened. And I think that that's one of the things we just wanted to basically say what we saw at the time and how it occurred, and whether or not the administration, what their version, to basically say that they were taking care of things and in charge of it or whatever, and kind of editing what was really happening at the time.
Well, this is actually the first time I've spoken in front of a Mormon audience since 1984. It's been a while. At that time, my dad was a stake high councilman and had asked if I would fill in for him at a state conference. He was going to be out of town. And the topic was service, not status. And I said, well, sure, I think I can handle that. And so I gave a nice talk where I made recommendations for members to serve and not worry about the status of, you know, a given position. One of those recommendations was, if we were serious about this, we'd get rid of the dais and have the authorities sit down with everyone else. And, this brought some change. High councilmen were no longer supposed to let non-high councilmen speak for them. I have not been involved with the church since then. My name is still on the rolls, and I hope that will continue. I didn't realize how emotional this whole experience was for me until last year. I broke out a video that Linda Brummett had made of some of the news coverage of when the ban had taken place. And I showed it to my daughter for the historical value. And still very upset at the hypocrisy of a flag-waving institution that would so easily... step on people. And I continue to be very upset about this. But getting back to what Gary was saying about the positive memories, it was so much fun working with what a great group. I was just one of the students who wandered in with a buddy of mine from home and got to know Ron and Gary, and Max and Albert was still there. And the incredible exhilaration of finding out new things that were not supposed to be talked about was just fantastic for me. And I would get mad typesetting all night reading Gary's columns and just swearing under my breath. I'd be so mad at some of the things that have gone on and swept under the rug. But it was exhilarating, and I do look back on it with very positive memories, and I'm really happy that I was involved. And in my case, I don't know about anyone else, it was detrimental to my testimony. I've since come to the belief that religion has more to do with politics than spirituality, and so I kind of gone out on my own spiritual course, and I like it that way. I prefer it that way, and I think members of my ward prefer it that way too. It was real easy when I became editor. I had a whole file of stories that had not been published yet, that maybe being kind of an outsider, I didn't come from Utah, I was from Northern California. I was not quite as concerned about the impact those stories would have on people who were upset by them. And I know this was a criticism of those who were upset, was, you know, you should be more aware of what of the impact these stories are having. The impact that I thought was most important was talking about things that were not to be discussed. And I think that's my fondest memory of Seventh East Press. When I first called my dad to ask if I should do this, when Ron and Gary asked me if I would be editor, he said, I think you should finish school. But so I went ahead and did it. But he supported me afterwards. In fact, he's here today, still supporting me. So I'm really happy that I was able to do that. I'm aware that I was a sophomore at the time. I wasn't a grad student or faculty. And the intellectuality perhaps took a dive when I came on. But the spirit was still there, and the excitement of publishing ideas. And now I publish boring stuff about radios. Not nearly as fun, but it all started with Seventh East Press, and I'd just like to thank these guys for asking me to come on board, and I haven't seen them in I don't know how long.
Since then.
But, in fact, I wasn't planning on being here today, but I had this dream, and just a couple nights ago, I was in a garden. There's a man who owned the place telling me I was going to transplant a plant that was next to a tree elsewhere. He said, "Don't dig too close to that root ball." And I thought, "Yeah, sure." So I dug too close, and snap, and this tree that's hundreds of feet tall just toppled. He says, "Not on the house." And fortunately, it didn't hit the house, but I'm standing there in this dream looking at this tree, and I noticed on the way down it was more of a pole than a tree, no really living leaves or branches. And I'm standing there looking at it, thinking, "Oh shit, how am I going to get this thing back up?" So I tossed and turned the last couple of nights and called Maxine and said, yeah, I'll come. And my name is still on the rolls, I think. I still have some hope that maybe there's some degree of tolerance on both sides that might develop. The hope is still there, and the story's not over.
Now, this session ends at what time? Quarter to? I guess I want to say something really quick and then turn it over to a couple questions. I like the metaphor of the train. For me, the Seventh East Press was, Anthony and I have talked about this as we've gotten together in Los Angeles over the last few years, and we had a really tearful session a year ago talking about, you know, where we've come and what happened to us all at BYU and how far we've all come. But I think we were trying to break out of the mold. I think all of us kind of were drawn to each other because in one way or another we were trying to break out of the Mormon mold and in some way. And I kind of like the train metaphor of if the countryside, if Mormonism is a countryside, I felt like I, as a woman, was on this train being hurtled down this track toward a destination not of my own choosing. And I was desperate to jump the train because I really wanted to find a nice little sports car and kind of drive leisurely through the countryside and make stops and sort of be in control of my own vehicle. And the Seventh East Press for me was a place where I found other people who also were willing to jump off the train and take control of their own lives, their own journey through Mormonism, rather than being hurtled toward something not of their own choosing. And I felt really lucky to have connected with people who were brave enough and strong enough to hang together and all of us sort of jump off the train together, knowing that we might be hurt, knowing that it would be rough. And I knew then, and I still know today, that I could not have done it alone. I would not have been able to jump off the train without these guys and their intelligence and their strength. And I will always be grateful. We will always be linked because of that moment in our lives when we all joined hands and jumped off the train. And it's been a really nice drive through the countryside the last 20 years. For me, I don't know. I can't speak for them. But I really want to thank each one of them for being a soulmate in this this life path and for helping me learn and being there to learn with me.